Hello there again, everyone, and good afternoon. This is TalkRadio.nyc. My name is Oscar Nordstrom, and thanks for tuning in to my new show, Off the Beaten Path, which will be on live every Thursday from 1 to 2 p.m. Today's show will be, as usual, as eclectic as the menu in a Greek diner. You'll hear a memorable and amusing story about what America's first and foremost raconteur, Benjamin Franklin, told Thomas Jefferson when the latter came to him to protest the Continental Congress's altering of the words of the Declaration of Independence. The show will also include a reading of reflections on how to keep in perspective the good and bad things that we experience in our lives. Before I go any further, I'd like to thank Sam Libowitz of the Conscientious Consultants Hour for his kind introduction and also for interviewing me on July 20th on my recently published book, The Fountain of Change. Today's show will include a return to the spirit of Dr. Albert Einstein, who wants to complete his explanation on the special theory of relativity and some thoughts on some social justice issues, which were cut short because I failed to keep track of the time, thus proving contrary to his proof that time isn't fixed, except for schnooks. Oh, well, thank you for completing my sentence, Dr. Einstein. Or should I say, feeling donkey. Yeah, das ist besser. The show will conclude with an interview with a gifted author, editor, and publisher, and composer, John Clifton of Foley Square Books, who was instrumental in the design, editing, formatting, and publishing of my first book, Fountain of Change. John is a man of many parts and is not only an accomplished writer and musician, but a gifted composer who has written many musicals. I think today's show and my earlier ones, I'd like to thank the comments that were made by Talk Show NYC's radio host, Rob Kay of the Rob and Coley Show, for sending a note out to all the other people on the broadcast to listen to the show that he found interesting and educational. And Rob's show appears every Tuesday, is on live every Tuesday from 8 to 9 p.m. Thanks for the kind words, Rob. And since we'd all like some feedback on the things we have to say, I'd appreciate it if you could log in. Even an emoji of a happy or frowning face would be great. Or call with your comments and questions. The number here is 877-480-4120, and you're listening to talkradio.nyc. Let's get on with the show. I'd like to open this week's show, as is my habit, with a quote from M. Scott Peck, famed psychiatrist, lecturer, and author of The Road Less Traveled, a book that was on the New York Times bestseller list for 10 years. The quote, "If we know exactly where we're going, exactly how to get there, and exactly what we'll see along the way, we won't learn anything." The quote in his book was the inspiration for the title of my show, Off the Beaten Path, as well as the diversity of topics presented each week. Last week, I started the show with a story about an amazing idea enshrined in the Declaration of Independence, which boldly stated that not only are we endowed by our Creator with the right to life and liberty, but more significantly, with the right to the pursuit of happiness. This far-sighted and abstract notion is one that only men free to govern themselves could aspire to. Those words were added to the first draft by our second president, John Adams, and the concept that spawned them is as true today as when they were written almost 250 years ago. The Continental Congress had tasked five Americans with the drafting of the Declaration of Independence, including John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, and Thomas Jefferson. And when they had completed the draft, they presented it to the Continental Congress for ratification before it was sent to England. Now, at the time, the Continental Congress was composed of the 13 different states and their representatives, all who were very diverse in their opinions and very independent. And since the Declaration was sure to be responded to by King George III by a declaration of war, all these independent states at the time wanted to make sure that the Declaration represented what they wanted it to. So in the end, there were changes made to the Declaration of Independence when it was sent to England. And upon seeing this, Thomas Jefferson, almost in a rage, goes to see Benjamin Franklin, who at the time was one of the better-known Americans and liked by all, because of his personality. And Benjamin Franklin was not only an inventor, but he was a scientist that was respected throughout the world. He had published the leading publication of his day, the Pennsylvania Gazette, and he was also our first postmaster general. And in that capacity, he set out the locations of post offices and the routes that they take. In fact, if you're driving along Route 1, you may still be able to find markers that he had set on Boston Post Road, hence the name if you ever wondered why it's called Boston Post Road. We can thank him for that. In addition to that, he'd also hold regular meetings with the young intellectuals in Philadelphia, and it might have been the first think tank. They would discuss just any ideas that they had at the time about the country, about science, about a myriad of things. And on one particular meeting, Benjamin Franklin relates to Thomas Jefferson, who had come to him to complain. And he tells the story that one of the young people or participants comes in and explains that he wants to have a sign made for a hat shop that he's going to have engage a carpentry shop to do. Now, this had to be carved in a huge plaque of wood, and it was very expensive. So he wanted to make sure that the wording was very good. I don't recall the man's name offhand, but the sign was to contain a picture of a hat, the man's name, and it was also contained the words, so-and-so, maker and seller of fine hats for ready cash. And this was going to cost quite a bit of money, quite a bit of words. So he sent it, basically said, does anybody have any ideas about this? Well, the first person said, well, I don't think you should have the word maker on the sign, because I don't think people care. If they're fine hats, they're not going to be concerned who made them. But more importantly, you're a young man. If you say they're a maker, people might even question whether you have the ability to make fine hats. So with that, the next person says, and I don't think you need the word seller. I don't think people are going to come in expecting that you're going to give the hats away. And the next person that went around said, well, I don't think you have to say for ready cash either. I don't expect people are going to be bringing in bushes of apples to trade for a hat. So in the windup, the final sign just had a picture of a hat and a man's name. And I'm not sure that Jefferson appreciated what Franklin told him, but I think he understood it, and I think we all can, because, you know, there's the expression applied here that many times less is more. And that also reminded me of a story or a letter that, that Mark Twain had once written to a friend, and the opening lines were, dear so-and-so, I'm sorry to write such a long letter. I didn't have time to write a shorter one. So I think there's a lesson in that. And next week's show, I think I will be telling some more amusing stories about Benjamin Franklin, who had gone with John Adams to France to plead America's cause and actually won their support in the War of Independence. And we wouldn't have won the war without France. But he was such a character that the elite in France was so taken with him that they all had paintings in their houses of his image. And King Louis the 16th didn't like it. And next week I'm going to tell you a story about how he responded to that. And I think the more you know about Benjamin Franklin, who Walter Isaacson, I read his biography of Benjamin Franklin, said that he was such a storyteller that if he were alive today, you could find him on nighttime television as a regular guest. He was that kind of character. So I think you'll enjoy that. I did want to pick up now with one other thing that I wanted to finish last week. I was talking about how to avoid the pills or avoid taking pills to deal with anxiety. And at the completion, I had said that if there was time, I was going to read something I had written, which will be in my new book that John Clifton, who's here today to talk about publishing business and other things, will be included in a book that he's putting together for me, Present Surprises. And it's not a poem, but it was a writing I call Reflections, because that's just what it was. And I'd like to read it today, because I think to finish the idea of how to deal with anxiety without the pills, one of the things is to keep life in perspective. And that's what this writing was about. And this is what I'd written. When life serves up a compliment, take it like salt. When life serves up ridicule, take it for what it's worth. When life serves up joy, rejoice. Tears, let them flow. When life serves up grace, be amazed. When life serves up anger, view it as a temptation. When life serves up beauty, behold it. When life serves up ugliness, use the other eye. When life serves up good fortune, count your blessings. Woe, do the same. When life serves up peace of mind, give yourself a pat on the back. When life serves up a tempest, serve it like tea. When life serves up a song, give it voice. When life serves up noise, give it a deaf ear. When life serves up love, let it flow without measure. And when life serves up hate, return the package unopened. I related a great story that the Buddha had talked about this point last week. I invite you to listen to it. I think you'd enjoy it. And I also included in the reflection something I had written to begin with to set that off. Where is it? Okay, give me 1 second. I lost my place here. Page 5. Well, I'll get back to that. I think now I need to move on because I'm having trouble, locating that. And I numbered my pages, and I've lost track of my pages here. So forgive me. But I can recite it pretty much from memory. What it said was that there are many gifts that we have in life. Intellect is a great gift because it allows us to appreciate all of the other ones more. And that love is a great gift because it allows us to basically get outside of ourselves and to empathize without being. And that talent is a great gift. And along with that, imagination is a great gift because it allows us to see without seeing, hear without hearing, and to feel without touching. And that faith is a great gift because it allows us to reach out to ourselves for something that's greater than us and something that's larger. And finally, life is a great gift. If we consider from the rise of man till today that you are alive on this earth, and all of the beings that came and went, and all of the hundreds of thousands of people, millions, billions of people, and all of the sperms and women's eggs, the coming together of two unique cells that made you is truly hitting a lottery of unimaginable odds. In fact, it's once in eternity. So I'd like you to think about that. And we're going to take a break now, but stay tuned. I'll be coming back in a few minutes. You're listening to Oscar Nordstrom on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Want to connect with?
Are you an entrepreneur or intrapreneur looking to build your following?
Welcome to our show.
Follow me Friday with Joan
and Priya.
Tune in every Friday at noon Eastern
on talkradio.nyc.
We're your digital connectors.
Woo! Woo!
What's that?
Talking Alternative Radio. 24 hours a day.
Welcome back. You're listening to Oscar Nordstrom on Off the Beaten Path on talkradio.nyc. We're going to be talking to my special guest, John Clifton, in a few minutes, but there are a few other things that I wanted to mention. I wanted to send regards to our good friend Terry in Ohio, recovering from a recent surgery, and I'm sure she's going to be doing well, and I just wanted to send out our prayers and thanks for a surgery, and also to wish Kathy a happy birthday. Back to the show. Dr. Einstein's been waiting around patiently because he'd said before, well, he got his time. And I want to thank him again for agreeing to appear on my show. Yeah. Let's get on with the show. Herr Know-It-Also. You mean know-it-all? Yeah, yeah. This is was ich mir sagen, Dummkopf. Okay, but before I begin, I must ask Dr. Einstein and the listeners for indulgence for my use on last week's show of his persona to voice concerns about where our colleges are headed. However, since Dr. Einstein was more than just the world's most renowned physicist, but he was also a man of great conscience, I believe he would never approve of what our colleges are becoming, basically centers for social protest, at the expense of the free sharing of ideas. As he put it, ideas are not good or bad. Ideas are just ideas. And just as theories remain so until proven, principles that will not stand up to criticism are not worthy of advocacy. And I also need to explain Dr. Einstein's use of epithets that were less than complimentary in characterizing our colleges and professors and media. And while I'm certain he didn't mean to upset anybody, I did use his persona again to talk about issues, particularly the current attempt to obliterate parts of American heritage without consideration to the contributions made and the mores and standards that existed at the time they were made. Certainly the meaning of our founding fathers was part of that. And forgive the sidebar here, but I believe the very soul of our country is now being threatened. In a recent show, I decried acts that sought to convict and discredit those who many see as great Americans and important historical figures without a reasoned public debate. And I'm not talking about Civil War generals. And the latest victim appears to be Columbus, an Italian navigator, who craved the belief that the world was flat when he tried to find a shorter route to India and the Orient and discovered America by accident. Believing he actually entered the Indian Ocean at the conclusion of his journey, he called the indigenous natives he encountered Indians. By the way, he actually landed in the Caribbean and never set foot on North or South America. And while now it's apparently claimed that his discovery was instrumental in the colonization and subjugation of the indigenous natives of the Americas, that was not his intent when he discovered the Americas, nor was he wrong in trying to establish a colony for trade. After all, he had been commissioned by Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand to discover a new route to the Orient and to set up trading posts to return with those merchandise. And the compact that he signed now, it seems to be being read as if he knew he was going to discover America and find, uneducated natives and then subjugate them. That's not what the charter was about. Now, I think you can understand that. The other thing that I think needs to be understood is when he landed in the Caribbean, the Indians that he encountered were at constant tribal wars with each other. The Caribs and the Kinibs and the Canibs, they not only killed each other, in constant wars, they took slaves as captive, and they even ate their captives. Thus the word cannibal from the Canib tribe. So although he tried to convert them to Christianity, which today is looked at, as the worst thing to do, I think his intentions to try to convert those tribes to be more humane and loving to each other, I don't think that was such a bad idea. Now, I'm not trying to paint a rosy picture that Columbus was a saint, but certainly before his statues are torn down and disfigured, there should be a public debate by reasoned, intelligent historians and others to consider the contributions that he made and to look at the mores of the time that he lived. and really come to a conclusion of what, to do with it. But instead of just going around ripping things down that have been there for generations and will be taken away from future generations unless we act with a little bit of conscience. I think I get back now to the beaten path and discuss what Dr. Einstein had come to explain, which was last week he explained the special theory of relativity with respect to time, and established that time is not fixed, but rather can vary depending on the observer. And this week, I'm not going to use his voice, which I do a very poor job of, but I'm going to indicate again what that theory, where how it came about, and how he applied it to the fact that space is not a constant either, but will vary depending on the observer. And last week's show, I explained that Einstein had been working on this concept of space and time for some time and struggled with a way to express what he thought intrinsically he understood. And it came upon him one night. He was traveling home on a trolley car in Switzerland, where he was a third rate, I guess, or a third place. He worked for a patent office in a small had a small responsibility there. And as he passed this big clock in a trolley car, he saw some lights and he looked at the clock, and it came to him. And this is the way I described it, and I think it's an accurate description. What came to him is that while he was sitting in the trolley car, or in this case, a man was sitting in a train, and he had a very, very super clock that could time the speed of light, which was fixed. That had been established by a Scottish mathematician long time before that. The speed of light is everywhere in the universe fixed, and he established that to a mathematical proof, and that was a given. So Einstein, you know, understood that. So what came to him is that if he turned on a pen light while sitting in a train and the light shined up to the ceiling, it would take some time to get there. It may not seem that way to us, but light actually takes, I think, like a little over 8 minutes to get from the sun to the earth. So it is fixed. So when he shined his light up at the ceiling and timed it, he saw that light took, let's say, a second before it hit the ceiling, and it hit in a precise location. And a friend had come to see him off, and he was standing outside the train and saw the same thing and had a similar super-duper clock, and he saw the light hit the ceiling in the same place and the same exact 1 second. So, you know, time is fixed. But then Einstein thought, well, what if the train starts moving forward? And what if it starts moving forward at an extremely fast rate? Well, what happened in that picture or scenario, if you will, the man sitting in the train, when he turned the light on, it would still hit the ceiling of the car in the same place in the same 1 second. But the person standing out the train would see it differently, because the train had started moving and the ceiling of the car now was forward of where the light struck, assuming the train was moving very fast and light wasn't moving quite that fast. So now the light hit the ceiling behind where the guy on the train had actually seen it hit. And because it hit further back, it had to travel in a longer arc or a longer route. And if it had to travel further, it had to take more time. Therefore, time was relative to the observation of the observer. Or to put another way, if the man standing outside the train had wanted the light to hit the ceiling in the same location as before, he would have told the man on the train to point his beam a little forward of where it was, so that it would meet the train ceiling when it came to it. So again, this theory actually was proven in the 1950s. A high-speed jet was sent with an atomic clock around the Earth, and when it returned, it actually recorded, although it was imperceptible, it still recorded less time than a similar clock that was positioned on the ground. So his theory was proven. And the same example that I just expressed, he used it to explain why certainly space is not fixed, but it also depends on the observer. And again, if we have that same person in a train car, and this time he stands at one end of the car and shines his light to the back end of the car, it would take the same, let's say the same 1 second, and it would hit the back of the car in the same place. Well, a person standing outside a motionless car would see exactly the same thing. But again, if the train started moving very, very quickly, the man inside the car would see the light take the same amount of time, but the man outside the car would see it differently, because now the train had started moving forward, and the back of the car had come to meet the light beam as it was approaching. Therefore, the light beam didn't have to travel as far to hit the back of the car. And with that theory, Einstein suggested that just as time is variable depending on the observer, so is space. And maybe I've oversimplified these principles, but that's basically the underlying thing. And the amazing thing is that Einstein understood this in his mind long before anyone else could ever ever thought of it, and so changed radically. And I think he used the word revolutionary discovery that had been man's basic understanding of the universe up to 1905, that time and space was fixed and everywhere the same. And next week, I'm going to discuss the underlying basis for the most famous and perhaps best known equation in the history of the world. E equals mc squared, where energy is equal to mass times the speed of light squared. And I'm going to explain the theory behind that. When I went to college, I actually had a professor who took us from the steps in calculus to the development of that theory. And I understood each step, but by the time he finished and ended up with the equation, I'd been totally, I could never duplicate it again. And it, frankly, I could understand the steps, but how he got from one point to the end point, I could never explain and won't attempt to. But I will try to explain the theory behind that concept, because I think that's something I think everyone could, appreciate and enjoy. And it's not, it's only now it's 12 years past the centennial of those discoveries of his, but they still ring out, to us. I think now I wanted to take some completed the thoughts of Dr. Einstein, I think it's time now that I'd like to get on and introduce our special guest, John Clifton of Foley Square Books. But I see right now that we're coming up on a break in a few minutes. So I just want to take a minute and explain before I introduce John. John had, I'd sent a manuscript to John that became Fountain of Change, which has been well received by a number of respected book review agencies. I sent him a manuscript of hundreds of word type pages that I had tried to put together in some semblance of order. And John converted that into a book that you would see today. And the amazing thing he did is when I first envisioned the book, I had envisioned a book whose title would have been Jesus the Man, because it wasn't about Jesus, the divinity. It was about the things that made Jesus a respected man outside of the trappings of Christianity. He was a tremendous social reformer. In fact, in the back of the book, I wrote that if he wasn't the respected leader of the world's greatest or largest religious following, he'd be hailed today as the world's greatest social reformer. So the book was titled at the time Jesus the Man. And the image was going to be that of Da Vinci's Last Supper with Jesus in the middle. But instead of having his apostles around him, there were going to be famous people that had been influenced by Jesus, like Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Mozart, Charles Dickens, and Fred Rogers. Interestingly, Fred Rogers, you'll remember it was had the TV show, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Time to take another break. We'll be back and introduce John in a minute. Thank you.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
If you have an interest in marijuana, you want to know about marijuana, law, policy, and culture, then feel free to join me, Joseph A. Bondi, every Friday at 11 o'clock in the morning on my show, In the Know 420 on TalkingAlternative.com.
Hi, this is Rob Kay.
And I'm Callie Alpert.
And we're hosts of The Rob and Callie Show. Are you looking for a show that talks about real stuff, like life, love, the pursuit of being yourself?
Then you have come to the right place, because we cover topics ranging from chivalry to gratitude to your relationship with money and everything in between.
So listen to us on The Rob and Callie Show, Tuesdays, 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on talkradio.myc.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back. This is Oscar Nordstrom off the beaten path on talkradio.nyc. And I'm here today with a special guest, John Clifton of Foley Square Books. And before I introduce John, I wanted to just continue a thought that I was expressing about what John had done for me. John is, among other things, which I'll get to in a minute, I'm going to read a little bio, helped me put my book together. And one of the first things that he helped, not only the first, but an important thing, was that I had an image of the book, which I expressed before the break, of a picture of Jesus in the Last Supper. And I expressed to John that, you know, since I had not written a book for Christians, but rather for non-Christians, atheists, agnostics, even people who have no belief system, that might come to know Jesus in a different light and perhaps begin to respect Jesus outside of Christianity as they would any other philosopher, or maybe Mahatma Gandhi, or Martin Luther King, or even Buddha, if you like. And I had a show where I likened his teachings to Buddhism and Hinduism, and the similarities that were striking between them. But anyway, I had this concern that anyone who saw the book and the image of it would immediately think that this is just one of the hundreds or perhaps thousands of books that have been written about Jesus. And this was not about Jesus as Christians perceive him, but Jesus as a great teacher and philosopher. And I talked to John about it. And John did more than just edit and format and design the book. He came back and he said, you know, basically, I agree with you, Oscar. I think that image is going to, people are not going to see the book as you want them to see it. So he came up. He bounced a number of different concepts against me, but off of me. But he came up with what I immediately saw as the heart of the book. And the name that is on the book's title right now, Fountain of Change, how the life and ideas of Jesus reshaped our world. And the book's cover contains an image of a very ornate and old cross floating over the globe of the world, which is really what the book is about, because it really talks about all of the contributions that Jesus made to our society and man's moral thinking and so many other things that are outside our religious aspects. So John was really instrumental in getting the book to basically, you know, point it in the right direction. And I think that came across so well. I sent the book to four different publishing companies, and they all came back, and one of the things that I was really gratified with is they were using terms like portrays Jesus as one would the Buddha or Martin Luther King, or portrays Jesus not as a man, not as a saint, or not as a god, but as a man who had suffering and trials like we all do. So the object of my book came across so strongly. And there was one other thing that helped quite a bit. I had a lot of footnotes explaining so much about what went on in Jesus' life. I explained that at the time, the Jewish hierarchy at the time were against him. And I explained in footnotes that it was understandable because he'd become preaching something that was totally different from what they believed. And they looked at him like a heretic. So I had a bunch of footnotes throughout, trying to explain better. And John said, you know, you're breaking the story up. You have too many footnotes. Make them end notes, just with a little, somebody wants to look it up, put numbers. And so I ended up with, instead of 150 footnotes, I ended up with 100 and something end notes at the end of the book. And that was another great thing that John asked me to do, because not only did the professional review agencies find that the book was on, you know, they understood that the point of the book, but they also said the reading flowed. One of them commented that the book reads like a conversation with the book. He's this intelligent friend. You know, he could have said a good friend, and that would have been fine too. Another said that the book clips along quite nicely. So John not only edited and formatted and designed the book, but he made suggestions that I just didn't see. So John is not only, you know, a gifted publisher, self-publisher, that we'll talk about, but he's somebody that basically goes far and away above what you, you know, if you went to the other major form of publishing, which is pay for publishing, It's just a world of difference. And I'd like to take a minute now and read a bio, or give you a little bit of a bio of John's background, because he truly is a unique, unique person. Okay. John Clifton not only an author, an editor, and a designer, but he, as well as is a composer and a lyricist. He is also trained. He's a trained artist and a teacher with a degree in design. And he's guided many first-time authors to a maze of the publishing business, including yours truly. In this regard, John represents a one-stop professional. As I said, who can not only format a book and edit it, but design the cover and the interiors to fit the book's theme, if you will. Johnson can also provide step-by-step guidance in a myriad of other details that go into publishing a book, which he'll talk about today. John adds to these accomplishments the accomplishments of title, author, and publisher of two best-selling books, Stop the Shops, Are Vaccinations Killing Our Pets, and Your Choice, Killing Cancer Cells with Pawpaw, the little-known treatment that grows on trees. For those like me who never heard of pawpaw, it's actually a fruit that grows in the southeastern United States and got its odd name because of its resemblance to papaya. And you can learn a lot of amazing facts about both John's books by looking at his website, foleysquarebooks.com, or you can check back with us, or you can call in and send questions in today. John will be happy to answer them. John is a true Renaissance man, and I hope to give him a chance to talk in a minute. I'm doing all the talking here for somebody who's going to be interviewed. As aside from the publishing business, John has many credits in the New York musical theater on and off Broadway, including composing many musicals, over 20 for young audiences. He's also written original scores for many plays, which have been performed in major theaters throughout the country. And John's talents have led him to working with many notables, including as a piano accompanist and musical director for such celebrities as Joan Rivers, Barbara Cook, Paul Sorvino, and David Hasselhoff. John is currently writing a score for a new musical about a true story of a romance between a young Fidel Castro and a Mexican woman, a romance that was not meant to be. I can't wait to see how that comes off. John, let me take this opportunity to again thank you for all your help and guidance getting my first book to publication. And a process that I discovered was much like trying to order from a Greek menu that was written in Greek, at least to me anyway. John, your company, Foley Square Books, well, I already outlined some of what you do in helping me get Fountain of Change into print. Mm-hmm. There must have been 100 other things that you had to consider and steps you took to get my book into final form. Can you let the listeners know how you approach creating a finished book?
Oh, well, you have to think of so many different things. As you said, there are many ingredients that go into a book. The first, as you mentioned, was the title. You know, most titles that people think of for their book, the first title they come up with is usually not good. It requires a process of like brainstorming, making a whole list of titles that you go through, and remembering that the subtitle can actually tell the reader what the book is about. You don't have to have a great title that tells everything in the title. For example, you could have a book called Hello, and if it were by Hillary Clinton or some famous person, it would sell. The title makes no difference. But if you're a beginning author, the title is very important. It's maybe the most important thing along a list of a lot of other things, but the title is very important. So we brainstorm, we take a list of 20, 30, 40 titles, and then we pick out the one that seems okay. And my test for a title is, if I were just looking at this title compared to that title, which one would I buy? You know, which one would somebody buy just on the basis of the title? before, that's before the subtitle. You know, most books have a title and then a space, colon, space, and then the subtitle. The subtitle is usually for the purpose of explaining what's in the book more fully than the title. So your book, like Fountain of Change, well, that could mean a lot of things. You know, it could be a fountain somewhere. It could be any philosopher you might think of. It could be, but because we have the subtitle that explains it's about Jesus and how he changed the world with his mind and his, you know, thoughts, then it's complete, you see. So that's number one. But, you know, most people, that's one failing, I think. But you were going to maybe ask me, like, what are some of the mistakes, the big mistakes authors make. The title is one. The other one, the big one, is they think that just writing a book and getting it published is all they have to do. And if it gets on Amazon or if it gets, you know, Barnes & Noble or whatever, that people are going to rush to buy their book. No. People have to know that it's there, you know? So marketing is a big part of it. And you should have a marketing plan before you even publish the book. You know, you should know where you're going.
You have a target audience.
Just as if it's a new kind of pretzel or a new kind of a cupcake or a new kind of car gizmo or something that you've invented, you have to have a marketing plan. Yeah. So I help people with that. And I'm not a marketing guy per se, but I can direct you to, you know, there are people on the internet who will all kinds of people out there who will take money from young authors, new authors. And basically, I think you had an experience like that, didn't you?
Well, I started out with one of these online publishing, and I was not happy with the initial results.
Right, but they'll take your money and give you very, they'll say, we're going to proofread your book, and then they'll put it through some sort of spell checker
program
or something. Yeah, and then charge you hundreds of dollars for that, and there you are, you're out hundreds, and they prey on new authors. So I'm there to sort of as a protection wall for people to,
you know, well, I don't think I denigrate them. I had a big experience with the first one that I used, name unmentioned.
Mm-hmm.
I just had a different vision of what they would have done.
Right.
And I think what you said to begin with is that they have to understand going in that if you deal with one of these agencies, it's going to deal with it from almost a surgical way as opposed to a doctor that wants to know the patient. You know, they just deal with a certain aspect of it.
Right.
John, we're going to be taking a break in a minute, but before we do, one of the questions that I'd like to ask you is, as a self-publisher, that people are going to come across this word print on demand.
Right.
What does that mean?
Print on demand means that you don't have to order thousands of copies from a printer of your book. You know, if you go offset, regular printing press, right? Print on demand means that when there's a demand for the book, they print it. In other words, if someone buys a book, then one book is printed. If someone orders five books, then five books are printed. And this can be done virtually overnight.
Yeah, and you had done that for...
It's a very good...
Basically walked me through that process, which is what I ended up
it's
using.
It's a very...
We're going to have to take another break for a minute. We'll be coming back in the final portion of the show and talk more to John Clifton about the publishing business and a few other things. Thank you for staying with us. This is Oscar Nordstrom on Off the Beaten Path on talkradio.nyc, and my guest is John Clifton of Foley Square Books. Thank you. Stay tuned.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Are you into comics, movies, and pop culture at large? What about music and TV? Then you're in for a treat. This is Michael Dolce, your host on TalkingAlternative.com. I've been professionally writing comic books, screenplays, and music articles for almost 15 years. Catch my show, Secrets of the Sire, at its new primetime slot, Wednesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and get the inside scoop on the pop culture universe you love to talk about. For more info, go to SecretsOfTheSire.com.
Hello, this is Mark Torres.
And Pronto Comics' own Dominic Sperano.
And listen to our show, It Came From the Radio, right here on talkradio.nyc, every Wednesday, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where we talk about entertainment, movies,
comic books, and other news.
So make sure you check us out. That's right here, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, every Wednesday, talkradio.nyc.
TalkingAlternative.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Oscar Nordstrom on Off the Beaten Path on talkradio.nyc with our guest today, John Clifton of Foley Square Books. And John was explaining the self-publishing business. John, take a minute and explain what the basic difference between the self-publishing and pay-for-publishing concept is.
Okay.
I didn't have any experience with the pay-for-publishing.
Right.
Or very little, actually. I saw some of the advantages. I mean, cost-wise and the control that an author might have. Could you talk about that a bit?
Sure. Those are two options that any beginning author has. Pay to publish is basically a company is a publisher. It's not you. There's a publishing company, and you pay them to publish your book. They, in turn, get your book printed and do all that. You get an author's royalty from them, which is agreed to in a contract, and they get the publisher's proceeds, the publisher's compensation. In self-publishing, you are the publisher. I show people how to form their own company. It's much easier than people think, you know. You don't even have to be incorporated. You can just be a DBA, doing business as. It can be on your regular income tax form, right? And there's a lot of advantages to having your own company because not only do you get the author's royalties, you also get the publisher's compensation. So you make a lot more off of your book if you publish it yourself. And it's very easy. People think, oh, I don't want to be a company. It's so complicated. It's not like being incorporated. You can be incorporated. I believe you are,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I am, because I had a corporation.
You already had
it. I made it a subsidiary, too.
And if someone owns any kind of a business, they can always add a book to it. You know, you don't have to start from scratch all over again. So that's what basically self-publishing is. The problem with self-publishing is you need somebody like me. You need somebody to guide you along the way. You don't have a publisher who's had all the experience helping you like you would in pay to publish. So you need a guru. That's what people call people like me, book gurus, right? And to lead you through all the traps, all the dangers of self-publishing. I mean, my sister the other day said, you know, this woman I know, she knew all these movie stars. She lives on the West Coast, my sister. And she said, she just published this book. She says, I loved the book. It was all this juicy stuff, you know, and very interesting. She said, but it was so, I couldn't believe it. It was so amateurishly done. She said, and the Kindle book, all the pictures were like black squares. And so I said, why didn't you have her, you know, call somebody like me to straighten all that out? Because if your book doesn't look professional, and believe me, if you're not into this, you can't do it. You might think you can, but you can't make a professional looking book. There are too many things that a critic can spot right off the bat saying this was a self-published book. You know, for example, let's say the little things. Let's say you put a page number above the chapter name on a book. That's never done, but people don't know that. They say, "Well, I can word process." You know, you always put the page number on a title page below on the bottom, or you eliminate it entirely. So I like to eliminate it entirely. Another thing people do is they word space. They like justified margins left and right, right? But it's word spaced. It's not letter spaced. So it looks jerky. There's some spaces between, you know, there's too many spaces between the words.
Well, won't pay for publishing straighten that out?
Pay for publishing would, but if you're self-publishing, then
you can't do, yeah, you need help
you
with that.
All sorts of things.
Can I interrupt you one second with respect to this? The other thing that occurred to me is you've already developed a dust cover and a new cover for my book, because since I published it, I have gotten some very good reviews.
Exactly, yeah.
That I would want to use.
Congratulations,
as
by the way.
And that's a pretty simple process for you to help me with. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I'm imagining if I had pay for publishing, it would be a whole new routine for them. Well, it's a new book. I don't know what would be mm-hmm. involved. But mm-hmm. with you, you just basically changed the rear of the book to show, instead of the testimonials right. that I had basically come up with
right.
about
well,
Jesus's,
when it's
you actually come up with another in the second edition. You know, we'll show that. I wanted to skip back for a second because mm-hmm. we were talking about how you would look at the image of what a book should be and come up with a title and an audience. I also wanted to publish, I had actually worked on for many, many years, a book of poetry that I had written.
Oh, yes.
And I wanted to publish the book under the title Moon's Touch
right.
with an image of a woman in silhouette against a large moon, standing overlooking on a peremptory, a large plane, with the words, in fact, the book was going to contain very short lines. One night, I gazed upon the moon and thought, so many before me had the same and sought to send the same to me and gone. I feel their touch and pass it on, which is a great
I love
thing.
That, yeah.
But you looked at it and you said, you know what? Poetry books, particularly a first-time unknown poetry, isn't going to go anywhere. The way I envision this book, you have an audience. A lot of the poems have a great deal of heart and talk to different occasions
yeah, they do.
In life, old age and things. And you said, I think the audience here would be somebody that goes into a gift shop and wants to buy a gift to somebody for their birthday or for an anniversary. And so you change the image of the book and change the title to Pleasant Surprises. And it's going to contain maybe half of the poems I've written mm-hmm. that are more directed to that theme. And that's fine with me. While it'd be more, I'd see it in a way as a commercialization of it. It still gets the concept of my poems into print and some place to go with it. So there again, you took what I said is, this is a great idea. Let me go with this. It's going to be, everybody's going to be reading my poetry, to something that I think is a much more targeted audience. But I want to skip yeah. back. I'm kind of pulling you away from, you know, what I wanted you to talk about. When you said there's a myriad of things that we have to consider, the first thing that really surprised me, when you did the title page in my book, and I looked at just the title page, copyright, ISBN number, Library of Congress, there's numbers that I never heard of,
manufactured,
the credits and so on yep. and so forth.
But that's the copyright page. That's not the title page.
Oh, okay.
That's usually on
if I was self, if I didn't know, I looked at this stuff, and frankly, it was all Greek to me. I didn't even know, you know, I knew an ISBN number because I'd seen it, but I didn't know how to go
right.
about getting it. So could you spend a few minutes, and you gave me direction on how to get all this done, the copyright and everything else?
Well, every book has an ISBN number, which is a unique number for that particular book, and it's what every librarians, booksellers all need, that ISBN number and the barcode that goes with it. So how do you get that? Well, there's a place you can go online that you just buy it. You just buy it like you're buying a pair of shoes.
Well, you did the barcode for me.
Yeah, the barcode.
You did that. I don't know. I wouldn't know the first thing about that.
Well, that's all. We can do all that. So if someone is doing a book, there are all these prerequisites that books have to have. You know, they have to have covers. We design the covers. They have to have the interior. They have to have the ISBN number. They have to be copyrighted. We see to it that they do everything properly. And it's all like a one-stop shopping. They don't have to go to a million places on the internet, you know, to get all these different things, because we either do it or we tell them how to do it, you know, to get everything all together and have a professional-looking book when they're done.
Yeah. John, we're coming up on the end of the show. We've talked a lot about it and almost just skimmed the surface. If we get the audience or listeners, if we get a interest in talking more about it, I wish you could come back, and I wish you could come back in and talk about your books a bit.
Sure.
Because they're so interesting, particularly what I would guess the years, frankly, of study and investigation and writing your books about vaccinating pets, and also about this fourth unknown treatment of cancer, which seems to be so helpful, that works with other forms of cancer.
Yes, yes.
And when I first heard the word pawpaw, you know, it sounded like ridiculous to me.
Right.
But I looked into it, and it's an interesting plant. People eat the fruit, and so on and so forth. So mm-hmm. we're going to have to take a break for the end of the show now.
Okay.
So, I'd like you to come back and finish the discussion, but we've run out of time, and probably, you know, for me having a guest here, I probably did too much of the talking.
Well, thanks for having me on, and thanks for the invitation.
Okay. We've come to the end of today's show. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Oscar Norton, and you've been listening to Off the Beaten Path on talkradio.nyc. I'd like again to thank Dr. Einstein for appearing today, who, by the way, has agreed to come back next week and explain his interesting formula, MC squared. Next week's show will include another amusing story about Benjamin Franklin, whose homespun humor took France's elite by storm while he and John Adams were there trying to enlist France's support. I'm also going to talk about a very highly controversial subject, abortion, which I've talked about some very controversial subjects in the past, but I wanted to give you my perspective of both sides of the issue, hopefully without, coming across as being on one side or the other, because there is no one side or the other. People say there is, but just as people who are anti-abortion don't believe every case of abortion is unwarranted, certainly the protection of a woman's life and the condition of the fetus and other things have to be taken into consideration, and I'm sure those in the pro-choice movement not all sign up for the fact that there are countries that basically abort fetuses because of their sex. So I think it's a very complex subject, and I think if we talked about both sides of it, I think we'd find there's a lot more to come together about than to be opposed to. So thank you once again for listening to the show. And I'd like to tell you to please stay tuned if you need to recharge your technical batteries to Adam Weinberg's Is It Plugged In, which directly follows the commercial break. Thanks again, and thanks, John Clifton, for appearing today. And thank you for listening. Have a great day.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Who do you want to connect with?
Are you an entrepreneur or intrapreneur looking to build your following?
Welcome to our show.
Follow me Friday with Joan
and Priya.
Tune in every Friday at noon Eastern
on talkradio.nyc.
We're your digital connectors.
Woo, woo!
What's that?
Hey, all you crazy listeners. Looking to boost your business? Why not advertise on Talking Alternative with very reasonable rates? Interested? Simply email at info@talkingalternative.com.
Are you into comics, movies, and pop culture at large? What about music and TV? Then you're in for a treat. This is Michael Dolce, your host on talkingalternative.com. I've been professionally writing comic books, screenplays, and music articles for almost 15 years. Catch my show, Secrets of the Sire, at its new primetime slot, Wednesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and get the inside scoop on the pop culture universe you love to talk about. For more info, go to secretsofthesire.com.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network at www.talkingalternative.com. Now, broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Hi, this is Rob Kay.
And I'm Callie Alpert.
And we're hosts of The Rob and Callie Show. Are you looking for a show that talks about real stuff, like life, love, the pursuit of being yourself?
Then you have come to the right place, because we cover topics ranging from chivalry to gratitude to your relationship with money and everything in between.
So listen to us on The Rob and Callie Show, Tuesdays, 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant. And on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.